Since leaving PI, he's been at Heidelberg and is now back today to tell us about quantum theory and space time with his perspective.
Yeah. Thank you. Is this thing on? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Or? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on. Okay. Yeah, so it's great to be back at PI. Thanks for inviting me, in particular to Lucien. So today I will talk about, as you can see in the title, a different perspective on quantum theory in space-time. And I will try to convince you that this different perspective, which is more information theoretic and operational, can give you some really fascinating insights that are not so easily visible from a standard point of view. So here's a little outline of the talk. So these are three parts. First part will be a glance beyond quantum theory. So we'll try to tell you in what way quantum theory could be modified or physics could be different, which comes basically from quantum information theory and from quantum foundations. And then if we have seen that, in the second part, we can understand how we can derive quantum theory from some simple principles. Some of you may have seen that, but this will be one third of the talk. The third part then will be on quantum theory in space-time, actually. So once you've seen that quantum theory is just one possibility among many others, then you can see that there are some interesting relations between the state space of quantum theory and space-time. Okay, so let's look at the first part. So you may ask, why should I look beyond quantum theory? Why should I be interested in modifying it? It seems so far that all experiments have confirmed quantum theory perfectly. So why should we generalize it? But then you can see there are actually a bunch of reasons for doing so. So just in general, you can say that it's in the past, it has always been the case that every theories that we have are at some point overturned and become show their limits of applicability. So this may as well happen to quantum theory. We might just one day discover that there's a limit of applicability and there's actually a generalization going on. For example, in quantum gravity, where people are talking about unifying GR, general relativity, and quantum theory, and then people talk about modifying GR, but you might as well talk about modifying quantum theory. And just more, a bit more down to earth, maybe you may just be interested in experimental tests of quantum theory, where you say, here's quantum theory, here's an alternative, and here's a different experimental prediction, now let's go to the lab and check this. And then also, and that's basically the reason why in quantum information theory these modifications have become important, is that it allows us to better understand quantum theory. It's like you take a point of view from the outside on quantum theory and then suddenly things become much more transparent. So it's like an outside view or a bird's eye view on quantum theory. It turns out that if you just sit down and try to modify quantum theory in an ad hoc way, then it can be quite difficult. So here is a paper where this was attempted. So that's a paper by Steven Weinberg on testing quantum mechanics. So here he writes, for example, that this paper presents a framework for introducing nonlinear corrections into quantum mechanics. That can serve as a guide to experiments that would be sensitive to such corrections. So he introduced nonlinear terms and said, here are experimental predictions that are different. And this looked quite well until a few months later when Nicolas Chissard wrote a follow-up paper with the title Weinberg's Nonlinear Quantum Mechanics and Supraluminal Communications. So he said here, we would like in this letter to draw attention to the difficulty of modifying quantum mechanics without introducing arbitrarily fast actions at a distance. So basically, he says that Weinberg's proposal allows to send information faster than light. So what this tells you as an example is that it's very hard to modify quantum theory in a consistent way if you just do it in an ad hoc way. So you better do it systematically somehow.
So faster than the speed of light is not inconsistent.
Not inconsistent, that's right. You could say it's still a feature that you wouldn't want to have. And then once you know you construct your theory, you found this new feature, you didn't want it, you get rid of it, you might find new features that you didn't want. So how can you avoid this? And one way to avoid this is to talk about operational situations which involve probabilities and measurements. For example, a Bell inequality violation. So that's one example where we can see that quantum theory could be different. So here, I will have lots of these boxes in this talk. You can imagine that these are really boxes in your laboratory. You have a preparation device, a preparation procedure, where you press a button and then maybe a particle comes out of the device. If you don't like laboratories, you can also think of a star in the sky just sending photons to you, so it doesn't have to be man-made. But something, you get some physical system and you can do a measurement. And the measurement has some finitely many classical outcomes that you can read off from a scale. That's definitely something we do in the laboratory. For example, let's look at measurements with two outcomes, and you can call them -1 or +1 for now. So think of a spin 1/2 particle where you can measure the spin in some direction, and it's like plus, it's spin up and spin down. So here, okay, can you see that it's a different color? Okay, sorry for that. Looked much different on the screen. So this is supposed to be silver and this is blue. It's very similar. It's also a measurement. It has also two outcomes. They're also called -1 and +1, but it can do a different measurement. Yeah, you can think of measuring in two different directions, for example, the spin. Then this would be a different measurement device. Okay, now let's label these measurements. Let's say here's measurement 0, here's measurement 1. And let's look at a standard Bell scenario where you have these two devices and you put copies of your devices and distribute this to two laboratories. Maybe here you have a physicist called Alice, A, and here's Bob, B. And you distribute, you prepare a pair of systems, maybe particles that are entangled, and send them to the laboratories. Now, you can decide what measurement you wish to do. So maybe you repeat this over and over. In some runs, Alice decides to do measurement 0, Bob decides to do measurement 0, then they get a bunch of outcomes, maybe -1, which is like the red dot here, and +1 here. Another run, they might decide to do measurement 1 and measurement 0, and get some other bunch of outcomes. So this is just a usual Bell scenario. And then you can just look at a bit of more abstract picture where you say, okay, let's forget the boxes for the moment and just say it's this black box which has some inputs and some outputs. So the inputs are either 0 and 1, which would be Alice's choice of measurement. The outputs would be -1 and +1, which would be the corresponding measurement outcome that they get. Now the interesting quantity is the probabilities that you see if you do that over and over. So you have a bunch of probabilities of outcomes given your choice of measurement. And in quantum physics, of course, this is described in the following way. This is an overlap with an entangled state that they share with some projection operators. And in classical physics, it would be a conditional probability distribution. But in general, you can just prepare this and go to the lab and observe these frequencies. It's theory independent. And classical and quantum physics both have a very important property here, and that's the no signaling principle. So this is actually about space-time, basically. It tells you that what Alice sees in her laboratory does not depend on Bob's choice of measurement. So what she sees is basically the conditional probability P of X given A, and this does not depend on B. And actually, this is good news, because otherwise you could put the two laboratories in space-like separated places. And if this was violated, then Bob could send information instantly to Alice just by choosing measurements. And this would mean sending information faster than light, for example. So this is not possible. So I'm sure you've all known this before, but nevertheless, so let's go one step further, which you also know. This is the Bell-CHSH inequality. So you can compute these expressions here, these correlators. So you multiply your outcomes together, given your choice of measurement, and then you take the expectation. So this is something you can determine in the lab. You just do it over and over, and you take the average, and you get these CABs. And now if you had a classical probability distribution in classical physics, then this expression here would always be upper bounded by 2. So that's the Bell-CHSH inequality. And we've all seen, and you've all seen before, that quantum theory can violate Bell inequalities like this. So quantum theory can give you more than 2, namely, for example, 2√2 if you do have a singlet state and you do projective measurements on it. But you can also show that 2√2 is somehow the best thing you can get. That's called the Zittelson bound. So you cannot get any higher value than this. And now this was the starting point of a question that Popescu and Drolich were asking in 1994. Which is, in a way, about the relation between quantum theory and space-time. So basically, they asked, given that quantum theory has this non-locality, so it violates this inequality, but it still doesn't allow to send information faster than light. Is this a feature that determines quantum theory? So is quantum theory the most general theory that's consistent with these two things? So are quantum correlations, these probabilities, the most general correlations that are non-local but still, say, fit into relativistic space-time because they satisfy no signaling? And then the answer, which at least I find surprising, I think many people found it surprising, is that the answer is no. So there are correlations, now called Popescu-Rohrlich-Box correlations, PR boxes, that are non-signaling but that are not possible in quantum theory. So what are these? Well, since these are correlations, this means that I just have to give you these probabilities. That's like a probability table. And here is the probability table. So that's it. So it says, if Alice and Bob both do measurement number one, then they get either plus one and minus one as the two outcomes, so like this, or minus one and plus one. So it's anti-correlation. If they do any other measurements, like both the zero measurement or zero and one and so on, they either get plus one or minus one, minus one. So that's perfect correlation. And probabilities are always one half. And then you can just sit down and check that this satisfies actually a no signaling property. So if you had these correlations, you could not use them to send information instantly. But you can also compute this expression here. And maybe you can already see that this is basically tailor-made to give you a very large value here. And it gives you a value of 4. So this is more than any quantum state could give you. So we learn from this that with no signaling distributions or correlations, you can get even more. You can get up to 4, more than quantum theory allows. So here's another picture of that. You see that picture very often. And it's a bad picture in a sense because this should be an 8-dimensional polytope, but you can draw only 2 dimensions. And that's a picture of all these P of X, Y given A, B, all the possible non-signaling correlations. And it turns out to be a polytope. And of course, the quantum correlations are somehow inside the set, and the classical ones are as well. But somehow the quantum correlations are a strange curved set in between these two extremes. So the classical subset is easily understood. It's like a polytope. The non-signaling correlations are another polytope. And in between is a strange shape of the quantum correlations that you can achieve with quantum states and quantum measurements. So you can ask, well, that's strange. So why is it exactly this set Q here that's physically possible? Why is it not more than this or less than this? So are there, for example, principles that determine the set, other than just sitting down and working out the Hilbert space formalism? And this is also practically relevant because the set is just hard to characterize. You might want to have efficient algorithms that do that for you, which turns out to be quite difficult in general. And so this has become like a huge research field now. Like many groups are working on this, have come up with different principles. And let me just show you quickly one principle that I find quite nice, which is called macroscopic locality. That's by Navasquez and Wunderlich. And basically they said, forget quantum theory. Suppose we have physics and we have correlations. And then definitely, in the macroscopic limit, the world should look classical. So these physical correlations should look classical in the macroscopic limit. And classical means they should admit a local hidden variable model. So here's a picture. Should look a bit nicer, sorry. Okay. So that's a picture where you also have Alice and Bob in their laboratories with measurement devices. But you don't send one particle, but really many particles, maybe 10 to the 20. And your detectors cannot resolve them very, very well. They can only solve up to something like square root of n. So you see some fluctuations here. You see some Gaussian distributions in your devices. And what this principle says is that these Gaussians that you see here, they should admit like one big probability distribution that determines them all, one classical description. And it turns out that PR boxes do not satisfy this. They would violate that. So this constrains your set of correlations, but it doesn't give you exactly the quantum correlations, but a little bit more. It's a bit weird. So here is like a, so all the quantum correlations, the blue ones, are macroscopically local, which is this pink set, but it's a little bit larger than the quantum correlations somehow. But for example, it enforces that the Tillerson bound holds. So you cannot more than have more than 2√2 on correlations. So I don't want to go much into detail of this, but it should show you that this is a kind of interesting example in what way physics could be different, which gives you a quite new perspective on things. So it could be more non-local than quantum theory allows. Or that's a second example. It could, for example, make different experimental predictions in interference experiments. And that's called higher order interference. This is something that's due to Raphael Sorkin here at PI. So let's look at this quickly. That was here, Raphael, and then later some other papers. So this is something you all know. That's a double slit experiment. And you know that quantum theory has interference. So what does it mean? So you can have a particle, for example, passing the two slits and then impinging on a screen. And suppose you put a little detector somewhere. So you can ask, what's the probability of the detector click? And now you can ask them in all different situations. You can, for example, ask, what if I block the second slit, only the first one is open? What's the probability that we call it P1? If you block the other slit, you call it probability P2. If both are open, it's called P12. Yeah. And then classical physics, you would expect that the probabilities just add up. So P12 is P1 plus P2. But in quantum theory, this is not true. And so this is exactly interference. Of course, you can say more what these extra terms are, but we don't care here. It just tells you the probabilities don't add up. So in this sense, quantum theory is strange. But it's also quite simple. And the way quantum theory is simple, you see, if you add an extra slit. So if you have three slits instead, then something interesting happens. So you can play the same game. Yeah? You can say, well, let's block one of the three slits or two of the three slits, look at the different probabilities. And then suddenly you find out that quantum theory satisfies this equation, which also classical physics satisfies. And that's basically the total probability if all the three slits are open, P123, can be written just in terms of pairs and single slits. So in a way, whatever happens with three slits, you can just understand that by understanding pairs of slits. And of course, you can imagine theories where you send particles to your slits, and this is violated for some reason. I can imagine that physics could behave differently. And if it behaved differently, you would call that third-order interference. It's a new kind of interference that you only see for three slits. But quantum theory doesn't have third-order interference, so it predicts that the difference between left and right side is exactly zero. So you can actually go to the lab and test for this. And here's an experiment by Gregor Weiss and some people who have looked for this. And the details are not really important, but you can see here that they really send photons to some slits. Some of them were open, and you could move them and block them. And they checked for this term, which should be zero. And then they bounded this third order interference term up to like 10 to the minus 2, for example. So this would be really different experimental behavior. Physics could be different. OK, so this is just an idea what could be different in physics. And now let's see how to formalize this and how to locate quantum theory in this continuum of possibilities. So the main motivation for the second part is this question that John Wheeler, for example, phrased in the following way. So he said, quantum physics has explained the structure of atoms and molecules, the behavior of semiconductors, and so on. So it's a very successful theory. This is successful, yes, but mysterious too. Why does the quantum exist? So why does the world behave according to quantum theory? And what seems like a philosophical question is now something we can address mathematically. So we've just seen, basically, that quantum theory is only one possibility in a large landscape of physical behaviors. So you could have classical probability theory instead. You could have more like weirder things like PR boxes. And you can ask, what's special about quantum theory here? Turns out that many of these theories are actually weirder than quantum theory. Like they can have more non-locality, higher order interference, and different other things that they predict. But many features are very, very similar to quantum theory, like you have a no-cloning theorem in all of them, for example. Now, the goal is give some simple physical principles that yield exactly quantum theory in this continuum.
Yeah. So with these other things you're mentioning, they're not actually theories, they're kind of toy models.
Okay, that's a very good question. So far, I haven't showed you what these are,
for
but
example,
I mean,
we know hydrogen atom cannot exist in classical electromagnetism.
That's right, yeah.
So, I mean, if you want to build an actual theory, maybe it's harder than just assigning some probability.
Yeah, that's right. But even for quantum theory, that's true. Let me say, quantum theory is about Hilbert spaces, operators, and so on. And you say, I want to apply this to fields, then you have to work a lot to do that. And here you would have to, the theories that predict different probabilities, and also have to work hard to connect it to some other physical stuff. So here you really just compare what are the probabilities and correlation.
So you haven't shown that there are consistent theories anywhere else there.
I will in a few slides, okay. Exactly. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
How is it that there's enough? I thought that in classical physics you could exactly clone a state. I mean, you can make an exact copy of the state.
You could say what?
In classical physics, can't I make an exact copy of the state?
Yes, but this is quite fascinating. So if you have the classical analog of a quantum state would be a probability distribution, an unknown probability distribution. There you can show that you cannot clone unknown probability distribution. Yeah. So if you have a coin, which is BS, this probability is P and 1 minus P, you toss it once and you get it only once, you can toss it twice, then you cannot create two copies from that. It's impossible. Yeah. It's a bit surprising, but it's actually true as well. So that's a classical no-cloning theorem in that sense. The analogy comes from the Lorentz transformations, and I think Lorentz transformations can be better understood once you realize that they also follow from two simple principles among all the possible theories of geometry you have. And now this comes back to what you said. What I have to do is first sketch how to describe those theories as actual theories, like quantum theory, and then explain the set of principles that give you quantum theory in the set. Okay, so what is a general probabilistic theory? There's lots of historical background. So it was discovered many, many times independently by many people. Jordan algebra is an example of that. Quantum logics is another one. Bayes norm spaces and all these things are basically examples of these theories. And the main idea is that you look at a simple laboratory situation and you say, any theory should at least be able to describe this setup where I prepare something, I transform it, and I do a measurement. And a simplest example could be a classical coin toss. We have classical probability theory. So think of a device, and when you push the button, it does a biased coin toss. So some probability for heads and for tails. And the transformation device does something to your coin. Maybe it rotates it so it's heads, tails, and otherwise, and the other way around. And then in the end, you do a measurement. You basically look at the coin and say if it's heads or if it's tails. And a bit more formally, you would say that the preparation device prepares a physical system in some state, which is now just a probability distribution, probability of heads and of tails, so P and 1 minus P. Now, if you look at these distributions, you can define the state space. That's just all the states that you can have. And that looks like this. So you could have 1, 0 as your probabilities, or 0, 1, or 1/2, 1/2. You get something like a line segment as your state space. Transformation would be something like that. So it's linear, and it maps states to states. So there's a state in and a state out. And then you have a measurement outcome probability, and this depends linearly on your state. So your probability for heads, given that you prepared state omega, is just P, so that's just this vector times your state. This is a linear map on your state. Okay, now what about quantum spin 1/2 particle, for example? Well, the device would prepare some superposition of spin up and down, for example. More generally, it could prepare a mixed state, a 2x2 density matrix. And now you've all seen that before. I'm sure that you can parameterize these states in terms of a ball, the Bloch ball. So you introduce these angles here, and you see the pure states are on the surface of this Bloch ball, and in the center, you have the mixed states. So in this case, your state space would look like a ball. And if you have a transformation here, this would be unitaries, for example. They would rotate your ball. And a measurement would be described by something like this, which is, again, linear in the state. So you can see it's very similar in a way. So in general, you may have a state space that looks quite different, not classical, not quantum, but something else. Yeah, some collection of states. And it's crucial here that these are convex sets. So if you have two states, you also have the statistical mixtures of these states. That means you can always prepare stuff at random. So it should be a convex set, so something like that would not be possible. Quantum theory, as I said, you would have a set of density matrices. Classical probability theory in finite dimensions, you would have a set of probability distributions. And then you can have all kinds of things. You can have all different state spaces, and it turns out if you know the shape of your state space, you can get all the physics from it. You can understand most properties. So here's a classical bit, here's a quantum bit. Now, a classical three-level system would be something like this. You have three configurations, these corners and the mixtures. What about a quantum three-level system? I'm not sure if somebody has seen pictures of this. It's not a ball. It's something really complicated. Yeah. It's the orbit of the three-dimensional unitary group, so it looks more like this. It's a paper by Tsiolkovsky who tries to depict this thing. But in general, you can have anything. You can have an arbitrary state space like this. And in quantum information, people have talked, for example, about the G-bit, which is not classical and not quantum, but it would be like a square state space. Okay. So now I've described, I've sketched you what these theories are. So you can, these are theories, at least in the sense that you can prepare and can talk about transformations and measurements. Now what about the principles? And there's a long history on search for principles for quantum theory. Let's not talk too much about that, but the new wave started basically with Lucien in 2001. And this was motivated by quantum information theory. And then in 2009, suddenly it became, yeah, there were lots of results out. So more or less different axiomatizations of quantum theory were found. And I will show you one of them now, sketched, which is like the newest one that I did with Louis Massanes and Remigius Augusiak and David Perez Garcia. So what principles can we have that give us quantum theory? And I will tell you four postulates, and these will give you exactly quantum theory. And all other theories will violate at least one of them. First one is continuous reversibility. So this means that in any system, for every pair of pure states, one can in principle engineer time-continuous reversible dynamics that brings one state to the other. So in quantum theory, it would mean you have one pure state, you have another pure state, you can write down some Hamiltonian evolution that moves you from one to the other state. So pure state is an extremal point of the state space. Now it's a convex set, and you take those states that you cannot write as mixtures of other states, that you would call those pure. Yeah, good question. Second thing is called tomographic locality. And this is, again, a setup where you have Alice and Bob, two physicists, very famous. And they share one of these states of your theory, but it's a bipartite state on two systems, and they can do local measurements. And then this one says that the state of a composite system is completely characterized by the correlations of measurements on the individual components. So what does it mean? So it means if they want to find out what that state is, they don't have to do like entangled joint measurements. They can just measure locally and then meet in the middle and compare their results. That will determine the state. And that's true in quantum theories. You can determine the density matrix in that way. Third postulate, that's very information theoretic. There is an information unit. So this says that there is a type of system, the universal bit, such that the state of any system can be encoded into sufficiently large number of bits. So that's true classically. Yeah? If you have any configuration of something on some alphabet, you can encode this into many zeros and ones. So that's what you use on your computer every day. In quantum theory, it's also true. You can move quantum states into a memory of a quantum computer, onto several qubits, and you can go back. And also, if you have two of these universal bits, you want that they interact. They don't just live and not talk to each other, like next by each other, but they can actually evolve in time in a way that correlates them. Okay, fourth one is basically...
The system is fine, right?
Yes, yes. For the moment, yes. It's...
Sounds like a strong assumption.
That it's a discrete system. Well, maybe, yeah. The philosophy of this is that if you go back to Bell and so on, then the lesson of that is that the main things about quantum theory, can understand them in finite systems already, at least regarding probabilities. Mm-hmm. The hope is if you have this, then you can say, and for infinite dimensional systems, you take a kind of a limit. Yeah. But it's a good question. So this is just for finite dimensions. That's true. Fourth one is something that Zeilinger suggested. Zeilinger said that a quantum bit basically carries only one bit of information and not more. And from this, you can actually learn a lot. And the fourth postulate is if one of these universal bits is used to perfectly encode one classical bit, it cannot simultaneously encode any further information. Then it turns out that if you have these four, then the state space must be exactly that of complex quantum theory. So if n of these universal bits, then it's exactly standard complex n qubit quantum theory. The reversible transformations must be the unitaries, and you must have the Born rule. And here's how you want to prove that. So first you look at this universal bit and show that the state space looks like a ball, like a unit ball of some dimension that you don't know, maybe seven-dimensional ball or something. And then you show that dimension must be actually three. Then you show that if you have single qubits and you take more of them, then they can only combine in a way which gives you standard quantum theory. So how is the first step done? So this is just in pictures. So you can start with an arbitrary state space, can look whatever it does, yeah, could be any dimensional convex set. And then it turns out if you had lines in your boundary, you could use these lines to encode extra information, more than one bit. So this means you cannot have lines in your boundary. And then you have this continuous symmetry that you can move every state continuously to every other. And this tells you, group theory tells you that it must be an ellipsoid. It must be the unit ball of some Euclidean metric. And then you reparametrize and you get a ball. So the qubit must be a ball. So it could be anything. For example, it could be a classical bit, which is a one-dimensional ball. Yeah. At this point, we don't know if it's what the dimension is. Now, why is it three-dimensional? Well, basically, you want two of them, and you want them to interact. Then you can do some group theory and convex geometry, and this is really not, it's quite heavy to prove that, but you can show that if the dimension is not three, then all these continuous reversible transformations or time evolutions just act locally. So one of them moves, and the other one moves, and they don't see each other. We can have only interaction if the dimension is three. So this rules out these guys. Now let me drop the third part of the proof and just look a bit more at this thing. So if you look at the proof, then the main mathematical reason that this works is that the rotation group in one dimension less must be commutative and it must be non-trivial. And this can only work for d equal 3. Yeah? If you have rotations in the plane, they all commute. But in higher dimensions, rotations do not commute. Yeah, that's clear. OK, so the take-home message here would be there are three independent measurements, called maybe sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, on a spin 1/2 particle state space because SOD minus 1 is commutative and non-trivial only for d equal to 3. OK, so far so good. But now you can say, but wait a minute. Actually, here you have x, y, and z. Why is that? Well, these are the spatial directions. So somehow 3 for the spin 1/2 is also the number of spatial dimensions. So this fits quite well, yeah. Which is rather funny. But before I go more into that, come back to that in 1 minute, let me just give you one more application of these axiomatizations for what you can do. So I've just shown you one of them. You can also do another one, which is something that Howard and Cosmin and I have done. And you can show that quantum theory, you can also get it from these four postulates. And it's not really important what they are, but the third one is important. The third one tells you that there is no third order interference. So this is the experiment I've shown you before. Yeah, if you have three slits, then everything interesting happens already for pairs of slits. If you put this as a postulate together with some other things, you get quantum theory. And now this tells you that you can do something interesting here. Namely, you can just go ahead and just remove this third postulate. Say, let's drop that. And let's see if I get new solutions. They would not be quantum, because they would have higher order interference. Maybe these ones would actually predict more concretely what to look for in these interference experiments. So it would be like concrete alternatives where you can test against quantum theory. So you can also ask, would this maybe describe different kind of computation? So you would still have lots of transformations like the unitaries. How would the computational power be if you compare it to quantum theory, for example? So this is one quite interesting thing that you can do once you have an axiomatization. But now let's go back to this qubit, which is three-dimensional into space-time, and look at this connection a bit. So we've already seen that it can be fruitful to think of probabilities in space-time, like in the PR box. You know, we said space-time is about no signaling, and then I want to put some probabilities on top of that. What can I get? But space-time is not only no signaling, so we can ask more interesting questions. Now, what we've just seen, actually, is a quite funny coincidence. We've seen that the quantum two-level state space must be a three-dimensional unit ball. And if you look at a Stern-Gerlach device, for example, it tells you that there is a really nice correspondence. You can rotate your magnet in some spatial direction. And this is the same as rotating your state space and measuring in different directions. So you have a one-to-one correspondence here, which is quite interesting, which would not be true if you had just some arbitrary state space. And Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, for example, was somebody who also found this quite interesting. And he tried to construct what he called Ur-theory, a theory which tries to explain how space-time comes from the qubit somehow. Now, I think you can safely say that this didn't really work. At least it wasn't taken too seriously afterwards. But I think there's a point that this is remarkable. And I think that, yeah. If you ask a standard physicist, so that's what I did when I was studying, went to my professor, said, isn't this interesting? And the answer was, well, no, that's trivial. It's totally trivial, because the qubit is just a representation of SU2 by definition. Well, then, of course, you have this coincidence. No? And actually, that's how I want to react to that. So hopefully, now that you've seen that you can actually get this ball, also from information theoretic postulates, starting from some completely arbitrary, I think it makes you really wonder why this fits together so well. That this fits together very well with spatial rotations, for example. So I would say this is really remarkable, and we should study this and see if there's an interesting lesson to learn. And so what do you do if people are not convinced by the idea? Well, you go ahead and try to prove a theorem. And so here's something that you can actually do. And the language is an information theoretic language, where you say, here's a task between two agents. And it has to do with probability and with space. So it's a task in D spatial dimensions. So you have Alice in her local laboratory and Bob. And we can imagine that space is just flat as usual. It doesn't really matter, but you can have that in the back of your head. And then Alice has this actual physical direction vector in her lab, a d-dimensional vector. And she wants to tell Bob what that thing is. So she could call him on the telephone and say, hey, Bob, I have the following vector, 0.2, minus 0.1, and so on. But then Bob would say, hey, but what's your coordinate system that you're using? Yeah. If they have never met before, that doesn't work. So she has to send a physical system. And physical system could be a particle or some state space, some probabilistic system. She somehow encodes it in a system, sends it to Bob, and Bob does measurements on it. Maybe he has a device that he can rotate in different directions, and the probability will depend on the rotation. And now, suppose this can be done, and this is a way for Alice to send directional information to Bob under these four nice properties. And these four nice properties are basically what a Stern-Gerlach device can do, just formulated abstractly. So think of a Stern-Gerlach device and a spin 1/2 particle, and these things are true. Namely, Alice can encode any spatial direction into that state. But if she wants to encode more, then she will lose some information. Also, if you want to look at the encoded direction and transform your coordinate system, then there's somehow a way to do this also in pairs of systems once you can do it on a single system. It's like do the tensor product of the two coordinate transformation. And also if you have pairs of these systems, they can interact continuously and reversibly in time. And then you can show as a theorem that if you have that, then you basically must have a Stern-Gerlach device. That's the only possibility. Like then the spatial dimension must be exactly 3. The systems must be qubits, and pairs of these systems must be quantum four-level systems that evolve unitarily in time. Now you can ask, well, wouldn't be the natural question not having a direction, but some kind of reference frame. So 3 directions that give like Alice's choice of frame. So it's like 3 axes, and she wants to send these 3 axes to Bob. So what if we play the game in this case? And then you can prove then it cannot work. So there's just no solution. So there is no solution which satisfies these 4 nice properties if you want to do that, for example. At the moment, Philip and me, we're looking at a very similar thing, which hopefully not a bit more natural assumption. We try to look at the relativistic case, where you don't assume everything is in rest to each other. The Hilbert space is known that they exchange. And we want to make contact to actual spinors and relativistic Stern-Gerlach devices. But that's still work in progress. OK. There's also work by Dakic and Bruckner, which is quite similar. And their main idea is that if you have transformation devices, which I just draw as boxes, then these are actually also somehow built of quantum stuff. So whatever probabilistic theory I have that describes my particles, the transformation device will also be built of those. So they think, well, if you have one of these particles and you want it to evolve in time, then you can engineer this time evolution of this transformation by letting it interact with many, many other small systems. So it's like if transformations where the particle just interacts with many other particles in a d-dimensional spin coherent state, then you also get the dimension must be 3 and quantum theory must be true. So very similar, the calculations are very similar, but it's a bit of a different motivation. Okay.
So I'm puzzled by something, because it's rather easy to write down the 5-dimensional quantum field theory.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And are you saying it's inconsistent?
No, it's not inconsistent.
So what's the problem?
It just doesn't. So it just wouldn't have these nice properties. So that means if you
have more information than just the spatial dimension.
Yes. So if you have like SO5, for example, you take a representation and it's not anymore a 2-level system, but it's higher dimensional. And so this, and then there's no 1-to-1 correspondence between the orbit of this group acting on a pure state and a set of all pure states. So this will allow you to encode additional information into that thing.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like fun.
It doesn't sound like a problem. I mean, you're saying there's a problem is the coincidence in 3 dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
It's somehow minimal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to higher dimensions, you can encode more.
Yes, of course. Of course, yes,
so
for sure.
A good thing.
That you can encode more? It's
yeah.
A good thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Of course. It would also be good to send information faster than light. I would love that. But we cannot do that. Yeah? And we can learn from the fact that we cannot do that. And that's all I'm doing here. Okay. So one more thing, which is a similar, yeah, this will be the last information theoretic task that I'm showing you, which will also be about now relativistic constraints on some experiments like this. So go back one step. So in this axiomatization, at one point I told you that it's somehow natural that a two-level system has a ball state space, maybe one or two or three-dimensional or higher dimensional. And then some calculations showed you that it must be three. But we can look at these possibilities in a different perspective. And we can actually see that, in a way, relativity of simultaneity in an interferometer also disallows all higher dimensions for the qubit than for. And now this is joint work with Andy Garner and Oskar Dahlsten, and it's work in progress. So we still have to think about some things, but I still want to show you the main idea. Also to see how these theories work. Yeah. So think of a Mach 10 interferometer, where you have two arms, and you can think of a particle either being in the upper or in the lower branch. And these are basically two possibilities. So you can describe it as a bit, a two-level system, and it may be described by some Bloch sphere of d dimensions. And so this, what I'm showing you now, is true for quantum theory, but it's also true for the other Bloch spheres. So if you're in the upper branch, you know your particle is in the upper branch with probability 1. This would mean that it's the north pole state of your Bloch ball. Definitely being in the lower branch would be the south pole state. And if you don't know where it is, but measurement would give you 50-50 probability, then you could, for example, have a state on the equator. That could be, in quantum theory, a superposition of the two with some phase. Generally, the probability to find the particle up here must be linear in this thing, and it turns out to be 1/2 times the z component plus 1. So where it sits here tells you what this probability is. Now let's look at a bit more difficult situation. So suppose you have somebody sitting here, and this physicist can put pieces of glass, for example, into the interferometer. So you can do a transformation here. And what does this transformation do? Well, if it's locally here, then it shouldn't change the probability of being up or down. It should preserve this probability. So it cannot change the z-axis. It must preserve the z-axis if you look at the state space. So whatever that does, it will be some rotation of your ball which preserves your z-axis. So let's assume we can actually do all these maps. All the ones that don't change the probability can be done locally. What does it mean? Well, it means that basically the transformation is a rotation of one dimension less. It preserves this axis, but otherwise it's arbitrary. So let's look at now two transformations. You have physicists here, another one there. They are space-like separated. They can locally decide what transformation to do. And now, of course, as usual, you can find one reference frame in which TA happens first and then TB, or TB and then TA. In other words, these transformations must commute. And it must commute for all TA, TB, and SOD minus 1. Well, what this tells you again is that the dimension can be at most 3. That's quite nice, because in a way, I've shown you that basically this reason that SOD minus 1 is commutative and so on was the crucial mathematical thing that we had in this axiomatization. And here it has some physical significance. So here it comes just from the physics that we need this.
So yeah, so you're getting a kind of puzzle. Let's imagine we did a Max Ender experiment in high dimensions. What would be wrong?
No, so here, nothing. So this is not about spatial dimension. It's about the dimension of the Bloch sphere only.
Yeah.
This means, for example...
I see. So you're saying, I work in a high-dimensional theory, I would still be using Bloch spheres.
Yeah.
Three-dimensional Bloch
spheres. You should,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, all and right. that's true, yeah, if you formulate...
So it has no relation to the...
No relation to dimension of space.
Okay.
You're using some structure here because you know that the order shouldn't matter here from relativity, but not, Okay, now, so you get SO2, but SO2 is just U1, so you get a complex phases. So if you have something delocalized and you do something locally, this should be a representation of U1 on your state space. So the question is, does this already give you the path integral? And very likely, it does not give you exactly the path integral, but will give you a generalization. Some state space where you have local phases acting as SO2 in your state space. And now what you want to do is actually classify those possibilities that you can have. Like, what are consistent ways to assign probabilities in Minkowski space if you have interferometers and you have the constraints that come from the spatial structure. Maybe you get exactly the path integral, but maybe not. That's the question. And if not, that would be exciting. Then you could write down maybe alternative quantum field theories in the end. I don't know. But there's a long way from the simple example to down here. Okay, almost done. This is second to last slide. So what about the stuff I've shown you? So basically, I've tried to show you that this is a kind of research that allows you to ask questions that are a bit different from those that you normally ask. It's not a question like, what's a good Lagrangian to unify two forces, for example? How can I write down something like that? It's more a question like, why should we have a path integral at all? Or other compelling reasons or assumptions under which we can make sure that it makes sense to assume it, or other assumptions under which it would make sense to say, makes sense to assume that it's modified. It's like why questions or what if questions. What if A was different, could we still have B? So the idea is that this hopefully gives you some insights into the architecture of physics, like why do we have complex numbers in quantum theory? Then you can give information theoretic reasons for it, and you can ask how the different parts of physics work together. And you do this basically by using abstraction and operationalism. I say, let's make statements and thought experiments that are independent of the specific theory that I'm assuming, or that's true in physics. And that allows then to ask these questions, which you might say, well, it's just philosophy, just to do it mathematically rigorously and try to get some insight into this. Okay, so that's my conclusion. These are the three things I've tried to show you. So quantum theory is just one probabilistic theory among many. That was the first part. And this could be used, for example, to devise experiments like Raphael's third order interference. And if you have that, you can derive quantum theory from simple postulates. And then you can play games and relax the postulates and see if you get other interesting things. And then in this perspective, there's some relation to space-time, which at least you can see that it becomes a bit more evident than if you just only know quantum theory and haven't heard this view from the outside on it. Of course, this stuff won't give you directly any theory of quantum gravity. That's not what I'm saying. but it shows you somehow how things fit together. And if you wiggle a bit here, then physics would wiggle a bit there, would be different. And that's the main idea. Okay. So finally, I'd like to thank my co-authors and colleagues and friends for their support and for making research so much fun. So thanks to all of you, and thank you for listening.
So, questions? Lee?
Several times in the differences in the plasticities, you have this postulate of reversibility. Given two pure states, A and B, there is this transformation from A to B and from B back to A. Mm-hmm. What if you drop reversible? So given any two pure states, there is either transformation from A to B or transformation from B to A, but not necessarily both. Mm-hmm. Do you get something interesting?
Probably you get lots of possibilities. Yeah. I mean, physically, you could say, why not? This would also be OK. But technically, if you just try to work out what the possibilities are, that's basically, then you don't have group theory anymore.
Yeah. You have semigroups.
You have semigroups, yeah. But I think this will become then much more difficult to say anything. And probably you can have really many possibilities. But yeah, I'm not sure, but I would guess so.
In principle, you have group-based. Yeah. In principle, you have group-based. It might have not the same system as your spirit and the reversible transformation between different.
Something like an isometry or.
Yeah,
that's fine. Then you can have your two. Map from smaller to bigger systems.
Yeah.
So, if I understood it right, the assumption of no simultaneous encoding ruled out polytopic state spaces.
Yes. Polytopic, but also ones that are curved on some part and flat on another part.
Yes. Right. Okay. So any state space with like a flat part.
Right.
Flat boundary.
Yes.
So it only leaves the strictly convex sets.
Right. So the question is, like in other axiomatizations, what are the features that sort of rule out such state spaces? Is there a direct connection with like the assumptions that go into other axiomatizations?
So in other approaches, you could take, for example, Lucian subspace axiom that would tell you you shouldn't have flats because a flat is like a subspace, and it's one which again looks like another bit. Two-level system, you would have the same conclusion.
Right. Yeah. It's not sufficiently information theoretical.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was just like something similar to no simultaneous encoding. So that's saying something that's independent of like.
Yes.
Mathematical structure.
Yeah.
Kind of sense. So.
Yeah, it's very information theoretic, not very physical. But now we have many different versions, and so you can just pick your favorite.
The other versions work.
Yeah.
So, first question I have is about experiments. So are there experiments which really try to seriously probe the limitations of quantum mechanics? You know, is there a Russell, in your view, which one is the most promising and which one is most likely to find something with the rest?
So I only know of experiments at the moment. And if you ask me how promising they are, then it would ask me to guess how likely it is that these people get the Nobel Prize.
No. The promising sense, for example, the experiment you showed, right, that did not look very serious because they put a very weak bound. They say it's...
Oh, yeah. Looks good point, yeah.
Of course, there is no chance to find anything.
So they have it now down to 10 to the minus 5, I think. That's Gregor Weiss again. And he does another experiment, which was proposed by Paris in the 70s, which is also an interference experiment. And it's made to test for quaternionic quantum mechanics versus complex quantum mechanics. Because that would fit very well to, it seems like, to field theory. There were books written on quaternionic field theory. And then the patterns would also look different. You would still see no thermal interference, but you could look at the correlations on the screen, and they would look different from complex quantum mechanics. But that's just built. I'm not sure if that's already been made. But then, of course, then this here will tell you, maybe this tells you, if you have quaternionic quantum mechanics, you shouldn't do the experiment in that way, because it will only allow you to see a SO2 subgroup. It's like a three-dimensional shadow of your quantum bit, and you will not see anything at all. But something we're actually looking at now at this is consequences for these experiments.
So there are a few quite successful reconstructions as proposed like in those last years, and they have different principles, like this Girbella, Gariano, Perinotti thing, and yours, and there's this Dakic-Bruckner is also a bit different. I would like to hear something about your gut feeling, like, because it's like you have still, there's still like the same mathematics. Mm-hmm. It's like looking, there's some light, and we just rotate the kaleidoscope, and those pieces of glass kind of recombine, and like with each rotation from paper to paper, switch paper, you have different axioms. Mm-hmm. But my question is, what is your gut feeling for this? What should remain? I don't mean all that remains, but at least something that should remain, you know, after some time.
Yeah, I think the question will be, what are, in this big landscape, what are like the closest cousins of quantum theory? Is there something interesting in the vicinity? And then I think that kind of axiomatization that allows you to get a handle on that will be very interesting in the next few years or for some people. Mm-hmm. Because these theories would not only in physics be interesting, but I think quantum information theory, you could just contrast their behavior to quantum state space, maybe look at the computational power. So my gut feeling would be that this will be.
And among those axioms that are right now here at the table, do you have something like a feeling that, for example, there should be like actually one axiom from one system and another axiom from the other, which are seem to be like the best ones? That is actually not.
I don't really know. It depends on what you want to do. I I think if you want to do quantum information theory, find nice Fourier theories, you should preserve group theory and use this reversibility axiom and solution. If you want to do physics, you might be interested more in the path integral. So you would start with a very different approach to begin with. You would not like to have boxes so much, but still maybe different agents that can do different transformations at different space-time points. So I guess it's very much dependent on what you want to do with it.
So the last thing you said is coming close to the comment I wanted to make. It's really just a comment, but I can ask you to comment on the comment. Which is that there's a certain mismatch between the way people proceed in quantum information theory and what we do in most of other physics, except maybe thermodynamics, which is that it seems to take as a fundamental the idea of subsystem or box or something like that. You ask about quantum field theory or something like this, you don't see any of that. You don't see this sharp separation of objects into different subsystems. However, there is a hint of that in space-time itself, right? Because there is a separation between one region of space-time and another region of space-time. That could be the basis for this notion of subsystem. And it does seem to lead in the direction of path integral. In some sense. Those are just a few thoughts. I just wonder if you can comment on that set of ideas. Another way of talking about the relationship between space, time, and
I think in the end, when you do experiments, you often do have the situation that it's kind of clear what you mean by over here and over there. Stuff you can control basically locally. Fundamentally, you're of course right. But then you can ask, how could you look at it differently or more generally, based on, say, let's start with classical boxes. And one thing, for example, would be that you look at relativistic quantum information. Say, suppose you have spin encoded in some particle. How does that behave? It doesn't behave so nicely like standard quantum finite dimensional systems, but you can still find traces of that. But you're right. I mean, fundamentally, there are no boxes. Subsystems. It's true.
And that's a little disturbing because if you want to make it the basis of fundamental derivation.
Yeah. I mean, the fundamental thing is not the box, and it's not the tensor product of the subsystem. It's more operationally. You ask, suppose I can control something. What can I learn from it? Just once you subscribe to the method that you want to learn something from impossibility, for example, in thermodynamics, it's impossible to have a perpetual mobile of the second kind. And it's very, very good. You can learn a lot from that. Mm. We're going to say it's impossible to break the Zitterson bound. Once you have such a situation, you can control the subsystem. You can still try to learn a lot from this, which involves situations that are not of this kind.
Right, absolutely. But then in the case of the thermodynamics, we finally got a deeper understanding of statistical mechanics.
Yes.
Which shows that there's some approximation in which this notion of subsystem. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that the derivations are complete, you get increase of entropy and all this. Mm-hmm.
But
so I'm just wondering whether this deeper thing would really need space-time. It's not essential.
Mm-hmm.
Whether one could argue that. And it's just,
okay, maybe we can talk about this.
I just want to add a very small comment to this, because, on the other hand, statistical mechanics can turn internally treated in information theoretical way. So, in style of James, so starting from just data that we have and constructing the formalism on the operational views. So, this lesson can be redone back in the information theoretic subsystem relation.
Yeah, so I wasn't so much talking about the information theory versus non-information theory, although if you know me, you know more of my bias. But I was talking about the notion of subsystem. Where would we get a formulation that depends in an essential way on the notion of subsystem? Mm-hmm. Statistical mechanics does not, but thermodynamics does.
I mean, even some of these axiomatization, there's not at least one which does not talk about subsystems.
Right.
No composition, just you need a notion of somehow closed system where you say, that's my closed system where I can assign a state, which may be debatable as well, but it's a bit less than one of those sources.
Are there any more questions? Okay, then let's thank Marcus again.